Hello and welcome to Community Conversations here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good evening. I'm Tom Maloney, host and moderator of tonight's conversations. Joining me here in studio is State Representative-elect Earl Harris Jr., representing District 2 of East Chicago. Earl, good evening to you.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
And joining me as well in studio here, Sarah Reese and Lauren Cross, reporters for the Northwest Indiana Times. Ladies, good evening.
Good evening.
Great to have you both here in studio. And joining us by phone is Indiana Public Broadcasting environmental reporter Nick Jansen. Nick, good evening to you.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have all of you here in studio. And, of course, all things considered, host and reporter Dan Clark in studio as well. Dan, good evening.
Good evening, Tom.
So we're taking, first off, I should note that we're taking questions, comments, calls, et cetera, at 219-756-5656. Or I'm sorry, wrong number, Dan. I've got 219-769-9577. 219-769-9577. Also with the hashtag on Twitter and Facebook, hashtag AskLead. And we're going to be talking about the West Calumet housing lead contamination crisis here in East Chicago. It's something you never really want to report on, but it has happened. And Lauren and Sarah, you've both been reporting on this now for several weeks, if not the past few months. Let's go ahead and, if we can, try to work from when it all began. And that's all the way back in roughly 1906, right, in the Chicago area, in terms of copper refineries and DuPont and lead smelters.
According to the EPA administrative record, about 1906 is when the USS Lead facility was first constructed. USS Lead, though, the site is named after USS Lead. It's the factory just to the south of the West Calumet housing complex. There was also a second lead factory that the West Calumet complex now stands on top of that site. That factory was demolished sometime after 1959, and the complex was built on top of it. That factory, I found from old newspaper articles, appears to have been built in 1912. It was first known by the name of International Lead Refining Company, which was a subsidiary of Anaconda Copper Company. Mm-hmm. And then later documents show that it also was known at one time as Eagle Pitcher.
Hmm. Okay. And what are the regulations like back then? In 1906, 1912, I assume, well, obviously the EPA isn't around at that point, which, by the way, we do have a statement from the EPA. We did put a request out to have a representative join us on tonight's conversation, but they were unavailable. We'll be getting to that in just a little bit. But regulations, safety regulations for the different types of chemicals that are being put out during this time, I assume pretty lax?
I'm not sure. Honestly, it's something maybe we need to look into a little closer. But I do know that the Superfund law was not put into place, I think, until much later.
Okay. And Nick as well on the phone, if you feel free, if you have any, if there's anything you found out through your research, please go ahead and let us know too. So looking forward and really fast forwarding almost 70 years, U.S. Lead shuts down in 1985, right? And IDEM takes over. But in between then is when the West Calumet housing complex is built in 1970 through 1973. What did we know at that time with regards to air contamination and lead soil issues?
Well, it appears the EPA and IDEM were aware of lead in the air from USS Lead. The Indiana had cited USS Lead in the 80s for air contamination. As far as what was known about the factory that once stood where the West Calumet housing complex is now, that's a little bit more unclear at
okay.
this point.
And so over the course of time then, Sarah, I believe you had written that the EPA in 2012 had selected the area as a cleanup plan and reached an agreement in the fall of 2014 with Atlantic Richfield and DuPont for a $26 million cleanup, in part because of the USS Lead Superfund site. Now, for those of us listening out there, what is a Superfund site?
Really, you know, a Superfund site is a piece of land that has been targeted by the EPA for cleanup, really a section of land that's been contaminated over several decades, perhaps, mm-hmm. Just has some kind of hazardous material. And the EPA, I think, has nearly 1,900 of those across the U.S.
1,900 across the U.S. And do we know how many are in Indiana?
No, we don't. No. Not off the top of my head.
Okay. There's at least a few other ones in northwest Indiana.
I think there's another one in East Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I believe there's about 45 in the state.
No. Okay, so about 45 in the state.
Can we go back real quick and explain the site? So USS Lead in the 1980s, after the state got involved and cited them for the air contamination, they entered into the EPA. There's a Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, that's probably not the correct. It's RCRA Act. And so EPA has a program, and RCRA Act, that program is for companies that are still viable. And so USS Lead, the facility, entered into the RCRA program, and a cleanup was started, I think, in 1993. Now, the site, USS Lead, was first proposed for the Superfund list in 1992, but then EPA decided to instead let it go ahead under the RCRA Act. And so the cleanup started in 1993 at the USS Lead facility, but the residential areas to the north were not included at that point. They had done some testing in the 80s, and some of it was off-site to the north, but none of that testing, to me, from looking at the record, appears to have been done in the residential area. It wasn't until later in the 90s, I found there's a report by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. They're the federal agency. They do health assessments for the EPA, and there's a report from 1998 saying they had been on site, and the EPA at that point told them, ATSDR, about the factory that had been torn down.
Okay.
The factory that was torn down predates Superfund, and so the focus for Superfund, after the cleanup at USS Lead, when it was in RCRA, they finished that cleanup and they capped. There's a landfill on site at USS Lead, and after that, then EPA referred the site and the residential areas to the north to the Superfund, and so in 2006. They began the listing process, so doing testing, or perhaps even earlier than that, and it actually made it onto the Superfund list in April 2009.
So April 2009 is still roughly 7 years after the initial cleanup from U.S. Lead ends in 2002 with the RCRA program, and then from there. In 93, it's discovered as well that there's issues with groundwater contamination as a result of contamination of the soil. Is this something then, obviously Northwest Indiana gets a lot of its water from Lake Michigan, but with the Little Calumet River right there running through East Chicago, is this something that could really have affected more than just the people in the West Calumet housing complex? I guess, hypothetically speaking, is there that possibility?
Well, when you get into water, I mean, yeah, you can. That obviously, water is going to go to more than just the West Calumet area. So you're potentially affecting the entire city.
Okay.
So I would. Yeah, the short answer to that is yes.
Okay.
I do know that they were doing some groundwater monitoring as part of the cleanup under RCRA, and they have said that they're not going to look at the groundwater again now until they go back to the USS Lead facility because they've divided it into two operating units. USS Lead is the second, and they're focusing the cleanup efforts now on the residential areas to the north at the operating unit one, which is then further divided into the three zones.
Yeah, 1, 2, and 3, I think, are the zones that people have heard so much about. Let's talk briefly about those zones, if we can, to go ahead and kind of figure out. So to put a map out there for people listening right now, the housing complex sits to the north of the former USS Lead site. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
I think Nick could explain the zones pretty well in terms of where everything's located out there.
And Nick, with those zones, there are three different zones separated really by just a couple of blocks. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the entire Superfund site is divided into two big zones that have been talked about a little bit, OU1 and OU2. OU1 is the residential neighborhood, and that area is divided into three zones. Zone 1 is the West Calumet Housing Complex and Kerry Gosch Elementary School, and Zone 3 is on the far side of the big OU1 from Zone 1. That's another residential area. Those two zones are being cleaned up under the consent decree with Atlantic Richfield and DuPont. Zone 2, right in the middle, which is literally just across the street from Zone 1. I mean, the border runs right down a street. Zone 2 is not being cleaned up right now because the EPA can't determine who's responsible for contaminating the area, basically. And they're still investigating that. And until they can either discover the responsible party or decide that no party can be identified and decide to pay for the cleanup on their own, that zone is just sort of in limbo at the moment.
I would add, though, that EPA has told me that they anticipate entering negotiations with private parties soon for cleanup money in Zone 2.
Okay.
Private donors, then, or just...
Private parties.
Private parties,
yeah,
okay.
Now, the businesses.
Okay, so the businesses, so are we looking at DuPont, U.S. Lead, et cetera, or the parent companies who have since taken those over?
They have not revealed to me the names of any companies, but they did say that they anticipated entering negotiations soon for Zone 2.
Okay, and just a reminder as well, we did reach out to the EPA, and their communications rep, Joshua Singer, did get back to us with a statement. The housing complex was built on former Anaconda Lead facilities in the late 1960s, early 1970s. EPA originally proposed the site for the Superfund National Priorities List in 1992, and starting in 1993, USS Lead began a cleanup at its portion of the facility. Now, looking and breaking that down at its portion, so we know that over the course of time that there have been several lead and copper and smelter refineries on this plot of land. And you talked about the private companies who may very well be on the hook for it. What kind of pushback or feedback, I guess, are these companies giving to the city of East Chicago, Earl? Have you heard anything in terms of them saying, you know what, it's not us, it's DuPont, it's not DuPont, they're pointing at USS Lead, et cetera?
I have to be honest, I have not been part of those conversations, so I don't know if there's really been pushback. My hope is there has not been, and that people, organizations, however you want to phrase that, will take responsibility and come in and do what they're supposed to do to help the city.
Okay. Have you found, Sarah and Lauren, that companies are taking responsibility for what's happened to the lead contamination issues, or is there still finger-pointing and blame going around?
As far as the negotiations with the Department of Justice, the state of Indiana, and the private parties or the private companies, and all of those details haven't been revealed as far as Zone 2. Obviously, in Zone 1 and 3, they've reached a consent decree, which is, you know, a public document now.
And just to be clear, with Zone 1, I believe EPA is renegotiating the cleanup of that site with the city, depending on what the city wants to do with it.
Yes, EPA is waiting on the city to decide on the future use for the land. The city was not a party to the consent decree. The consent decree is between the United States, the state of Indiana, and the businesses.
Okay, and so through the course of this, I guess, going back as we're still working on the history, you're joining us on Community Conversations. I'm Tom Maloney, host and moderator, joined alongside State Representative-elect Earl Harris, Jr. of District 2, Lauren Cross and Sarah Reese of the Northwest Indiana Times, Nick Jansen of Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Dan Clark of Lakeshore Public Radio, talking about the West Calumet Housing Complex lead contamination issues. We're taking your calls at 219-769-9577 and on Twitter and Facebook with the hashtag Ask Led. Going through the history still, because there's just so much history here that we are still really, no pun intended, digging through. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of information out there that still has to be gone through. In 1997, free lead screenings are made available to residents after the EPA, the ISDH, the Indiana State Department of Health fine residents planting gardens in the soil along with the elementary school being located, Kerry Ghosh. The Times says, quote, a total of 95 people were tested. Of those, 30 were children ages 6 or younger. 10 of those 30 children had a blood level of 10 micrograms per deciliter or greater. 8 of the children lived in the West Calumet housing complex. 1 child age 6 or younger in Calumet tested at 41 micrograms per deciliter, and an 8-year-old with a history of elevated blood lead levels tested at 39 micrograms per deciliter. I'm not a scientist. I'm a simple radio guy. What do these numbers mean? 39 micrograms per deciliter. I can't imagine it's good.
Right.
Probably not.
The CDC currently, in 2012, they reduced that action threshold to 5 micrograms per deciliter. So that's just some perspective. Mm-hmm. So if you're seeing 39, there could be cause for concern. I guess the focus needs to be on, is it persistent? You know, are these blood levels continuing as well? I believe...
Continuing in the same person or just continuing through numerous people through the course? Okay.
Both, really. Obviously there's monitoring involved if it's above 5 micrograms per deciliter, but keep in mind, in 1997, I'm not sure what the CDC's threshold was then. It obviously, you know, with Flint, Michigan, the lead crisis there, there's been a renewed push just monitoring of lead levels within children. So.
And speaking of Flint, I guess let's talk about Flint for a moment. There have been a lot of comparisons nationally and locally from national media, the New York Times, national media like CNN, locally, just residents in Northwest Indiana have compared this to Flint. The fallout from Flint is that Susan Hedman steps down from the EPA in Region 5, and then Robert Kaplan takes over. And is obviously the EPA, having known about this for a long time, what types of similarities, if any, are there to Flint? Obviously, Flint is government, I guess, government faulted, government enacted, in the sense of they wanted to save money, so they switched the water source in Flint, Michigan, to the contaminated Flint River. This is more big business and less government, I guess, right?
A different part of EPA, actually. What EPA has different divisions. One part oversees water, and then Superfund is another part. Mm-hmm. So different personnel working on different projects. And yes, like you said, in Flint, it's something that happened recently that led to this change, whereas in East Chicago, this is contamination that likely was put there 100 years ago, or more.
That's an important point. I think that's a very important thing to point out, is what happened in Flint was someone made a decision, mm-hmm. and they specifically made a decision for supposedly financial reasons that affected all these people versus, as just pointed out, this was something that happened 100 years ago.
Yeah.
People whom are involved with the city, involved with the state, that live there now, obviously 100 years ago, mm-hmm. were not there. So it's not, you really can't compare them to each other completely.
Nick, go on.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, another difference is lead in water is very readily taken in by the body, whereas lead in soil, a little less so. However, if the soil has been contaminated for decades, then, you have to look at it with a different time frame in mind.
Okay, so I guess me playing the part of a fool here, I mean, we're talking about kids who are going out and playing in the dirt. We're talking about gardens of tomatoes and squash, zucchini, peppers being planted in backyards, being eaten and ingested. I'm sure you all, when you were kids, and I'm sure when I was a kid, you play in the dirt, you stick your hands in your mouth, right? So there's still the possibility of, I guess, severe lead contamination, as opposed to, is there really such a stark difference between the dirt and the water, or is this really apples and oranges?
Well, when you look at water, unless I'm mistaken, all of us drink water. So right. that's mm-hmm. a situation where everyone, you're taking in water constantly mm-hmm. every day, day after day. Clearly dirt, you can have an effect because, as you said, you know, trying to get a kid during the summertime not to play outside is almost impossible because right. they're kids, so they want to be out. And, you know, playing in dirt, bringing it in their shoes, et cetera. So it's again, I don't think it's a fair comparison to put them together.
Okay.
Because you're not ingesting, you know, maybe some kids that accident or on purpose eat dirt, but mm-hmm. you don't really look at like water. You're purposefully ingesting water
right.
in all day long.
And we've seen,
and cooking in it and bathing
right.
in it. And
the bottled water in Flint was such a big deal. And, you know, they're working on replacing the lead pipes, obviously. So,
One thing let me yeah, mention, Sarah. Though, is that health experts have told me recently that the effects that lead build up in your body is cumulative. So, mm-hmm. You know, your water may have, it may not be over the allowable limit for lead, but if your
right.
water has some lead, not above the limit, and you have lead in your soil and you're ingesting dust, or mm-hmm. especially children with the hand-to-mouth behavior mm-hmm. are particularly at risk with contaminated soil, and any other sources, for instance, paint was a big deal, and the housing in the Calumet neighborhood mm-hmm. all predates 1978, so there could
which be, is when they enacted the no lead paint in households.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So there could be lead paint in those houses, and with all those sources, your body doesn't distinguish between where the lead is coming from.
Okay.
It just absorbs it, and so there's a cumulative effect.
And so it's sort of compounding interest in terms of lead in the body. So going back again through the history, and let's look at the, Kirigosh Elementary School, right? So Garfield School burns down in 1956, and Kirigosh is built in 58-59, and then a new Kirigosh is built in 1997. And following the building of Kirigosh in 97, the previous one that was built in the late 1950s is torn down. What is the thought process here of building an elementary school in an area that they already knew had contaminated lead, contaminated soil from lead, air particles found to have lead and arsenic? Couldn't they have built Kirigosh anywhere else in the area outside of the West Calumet housing complex area that it was built in?
Well, that's a good question. The EPA actually was, it appears from Indiana Department of Environmental Management memo
mm-hmm.
In 1997 that someone from EPA was on site and saw the construction of the new school and raised some questions.
Okay.
So then they conducted some soil testing, and they found mostly at Kirigosh that the soil tests were below the allowable level for that particular use, which is 400 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
They did find one area that was above, and so that item had scheduled remediation. I'm not quite clear on the extent or exactly how much soil was removed, or if it was even completed, but I'm assuming it was because documents say it had been scheduled. And then I do know that the EPA has released the soil testing results from the most recent round of testing at Kirigosh.
Mm-hmm.
And again, most of the areas were below the limit. There was one area that was over.
Mm-hmm.
And so at is it Gosh or Gosh?
Kirigosh.
Kirigosh, okay. So I've been mispronouncing. I'd apologize. At Kirigosh, they have to move the school, and they do so a couple of weeks before the school year starts.
Correct.
And there's fear that I believe it was an article in the Times, and there's fear that East Chicago schools wouldn't get the state appropriated amounts of money to help fund education when the school system as a whole over the last couple of years has faced significant debt. They finally get themselves out of debt. They run into this situation. They have the available facility. But now, as people are moving out of the East Chicago school system, whether or not they lived in West Calumet or not, going to other school systems, there's worry, there's fear that when they do the headcounts twice a year to go ahead and provide funding, Earl, you're nodding your head. Is there an update here? Will East Chicago continue to get the state funding for education that it's supposed to get?
So if I can give it a little bit of backstory.
Yes.
There are vouchers so that the residents that live in the area can move. The thing is, they can move wherever they want.
Okay. So and the other part is there's only so much limited space in East Chicago. So it's not as if we can take a whole area, mm-hmm. move it to an empty part of East Chicago, sure. because it doesn't exist. So you have families that will move to Gary, to Hammond. I've heard of people going to Indianapolis. They may move out of the state. Mm-hmm. And so I had a brief conversation with the superintendent, who's also new, and welcome to this.
Yeah,
welcome to your dream job. Here you go. So as you said, the school systems receive funding depending upon the numbers of students. Mm-hmm. So you get X amount of dollars per student. As she and I had the conversation, actually one of the board members was there as well. The school city has put themselves in terms of financially, in terms of figuring out what they're going to do based on what their projected numbers is. Now you're looking at, I believe there's about 600-700 students. Mm-hmm. And I don't think all of them will leave the Chicago school system, but there's going to be a chunk of them.
Okay.
So now you're potentially looking at millions of dollars that the school city budgeted for.
Yes.
That now will go away. And as the superintendent made the comment to me, she's not sure if she can make payroll. So I know that there was there has been some financial help that has come in the terms of, I believe, Eddie Melton, who's the incoming state senator, mm-hmm. as part of the state school board, that they provided some funding, a loan, to the school system to mm-hmm. help get through this situation, because you have other factors, not only the students leaving, but moving, reopening a school because they moved to a school that was
right.
closed, and all the things that go with that. There's probably things I can't even talk to you about now because I don't know. But and so I know Eddie is, as a conversation had recently, they're working on trying to forgive that loan so the mm-hmm. school system does not have to give the money back, because okay. it's a pretty sizable hit. But this is a long-term effect, because, again, you have students that left East Chicago, and they're probably not going to come back. I don't know if 100% of them will not,
right.
but there's a good
bound
chance.
Bound to be, yeah. I'm sure some people just aren't going to return.
They're not going to return.
Somewhere else.
Exactly. And you can't blame them for that. They have to find a new place to live. They can't live here, and so they're going to go. Mm-hmm. You also have what's the financial impact of a school, as you said, which is not that old.
Mm-hmm.
What's the financial impact of that in terms of the school system having that building, and if it's torn down, or is the school system going to be financially responsible for doing something with it?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of other factors in terms of the educational school system and what they have to deal with.
And they just had to fix up the middle school that they moved into mm-hmm. as well, to kind of make it ready for elementary school people.
And they had to do it like that.
I mean, it's
not as if they had six, nine months or a year to do this. They had to do it very quickly.
Yeah, for the start of the school year.
And for those of you out there listening and wondering what Dan means, think about the size of an eighth grader compared to the size of a third grader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bathrooms had to get changed out. Water fountains had to get changed out. Desk chairs and desks that students are using have to get changed out. And this is an ongoing process that isn't cheap and it's not free. And so, you know, money is coming out of the Chicago school system, no doubt out of the pockets of teachers and of educational providers as well there.
And did you also have, and I don't know the answer to this, but did the school system have to do repairs to the building because mm-hmm. it was closed, you didn't take care of? Were there upgrades in terms of technology that may have been at Kerry Gosch that mm-hmm. are not at this school? So there's mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a long list of things the school system is dealing with or had to deal with to get the school open.
And let's talk about, if we can, the effects of lead poisoning on children. Because at the heart of it, ultimately, I guess, is always that angle of, well, what about the children? And children have tested for incredibly high levels of lead over the last several years. There's reports that it causes slowdowns in learning, it causes hearing issues, developmental issues, and this is an issue with the West Calumet housing complex having been built in, what was it again, the 1970s? Early 1970s. So you have people there for the last 40-plus years who may have been born and raised and still live there. And as kids, the immune system isn't quite nearly as high. What kinds of, I guess, things are we looking at with development for children here?
Right, and you made a good point that it's really 0 to 6 years old that you need to be worried about, because their brain's still developing, and lead can literally leach into the body much mm-hmm. easier that way when you're that young. You're talking about low IQ points, learning disabilities, hyperactivity, and actually I think there are some studies out there that show that it leads to, I guess, an inclination to commit crimes as well, which
interesting.
Is interesting. Right. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concerns, especially with children. don't know if you have anything to add.
And, I mean, the effects are irreversible. So lower IQ is that's forever.
Yeah.
They're not going to suddenly get better. All you can do is try to reduce the amount of lead in your body so that you don't you're not further affected.
I want to go to something you said, you know, and this has been part of the thinking in meetings and conversations I've been part of. You, as you said, there are people who've lived there their entire lives.
Yeah.
Well, there are also people who used to live there that have moved to other parts of the state, other parts of the country. And so there's a, been an effort also to reach out and make sure that we, East Chicago, the area, et cetera, know whom those families are and where they have moved to, because they need to be notified.
Right.
Hey, you may have spent the first 10 years of your life here. Your family then moved to Indianapolis or Texas or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
But and if there have been some issues with you as a child or your children, you need to know what has happened here. So there's been a lot of outreach and looking. Some research is, I believe there's a committee that's working on researching families to make sure that that notification happens.
In terms of families and how people feel, you're obviously out there with people all the time talking to them. What's how do they feel about all this? What's going on out there?
Well,
I know Nick as well can answer to this too, but
it's a mixture. I mean, of course, you have anger, but the biggest thing is you have fear. People are now afraid. What is this going to do? We're talking about children. I mean, anyone that's a parent, you've now been told your child potentially, you know, has issues or would be developmentally slow or have physical issues, whatever the issues. Now you know why, if you didn't know, or you have fear that they could have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked to some people. There was a parent recently talked to, and I think she has 6 children, and they're still there. They haven't moved out yet, and she's, you know, kind of freaking out, and I don't blame people that for doing that. And you also have to think about, besides the health issues, you also have to think about now people have to find a new place to live.
Yeah.
So they've lived here, their lives are structured here. Now they have to find a new place. Now they have to restructure their life. Well, what if their job, if they don't have transportation and they are able to walk a block, get on the bus, take the bus to where they work, now they have to find a new place. They may not be able to do that. So you have those kind of fear factors as well, where people have talked about, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have to figure out how I'm going to – and also we talked about schools. Mm-hmm. How do I get my kids to school?
Sure, yeah.
How do I make sure they have a good education? So there's so – I mean, we could talk for hours more about this.
Yeah.
There's so many factors in terms of the fears that parents have. Mm-hmm. And not that this is most important, but you also have homeowners in the area who now have to worry about the financial part.
Mm-hmm.
Right. My property value just nosedived, and I can't sell it. I may still owe
no
a large amount.
That.
Yeah, no one's going to buy it.
Yeah.
I may still owe a huge amount of money. Now what do I do
right,
with my property now?
Mm-hmm.
And, so and there's Nick, a lot of factors.
Nick, you spoke with someone when you were out reporting out there, someone who they had health concerns, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken with a lot of different people who have different health concerns. And, I mean, I would totally echo what was just said. I think from the people, the residents I've spoken with, the biggest feeling is fear, you know. Fear about where these health effects are coming from, even if it's not because of lead, you know, people will remember ailments they have and wonder about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fear there is from an uncertainty. I mean, a lot of people still feel like they haven't been given all the information, whether it's about health effects, whether it's about what kind of housing assistance they're going to get. And so when they don't feel like they've been getting enough information or the proper information, those feelings just kind of linger and fester.
Sure.
And Sarah and Lauren, you've both been on top of this for quite some time. I can imagine the sentiment rings true in the residents that you've talked with as well. Fear.
Right, right. You know, for the last couple of months, I've been just meeting with residents, you know, one mother in particular. She moved into the housing complex last year in August.
Mm-hmm.
Her daughter, who was 1 year old at the time, suffered some seizures shortly after moving to the complex. And, of course, there's no way to tell if lead was the culprit, but that's on her mind now. And she's really concerned.
And is there any way to prove? Nick, I know that you spoke with a guy who's now, I believe, in his 40s or 50s, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even older, who had bone cancer. And bone cancer is a symptom of lead poisoning. But is there any way to go back and say, yes, this is definitively what caused my bone cancer? Lauren, is there any way that that mother can go back and say, yes, this is definitively what caused those seizures in my 1-year-old child? Is there any way to know that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a difficult question to answer, you know, you'd have to probably talk to a pediatrician. And mm-hmm. even then, I think it is very difficult to prove. It is very difficult to link lead with specific health conditions.
And let's not forget that there's arsenic, too, which is a carcinogen.
Right. Right. There's little talk about arsenic, but we should probably get into that at some point.
It's in there. Nick, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, there really is no way to pinpoint a specific health effect with lead poisoning. Health officials are very hesitant to do that because even though lead does cause certain issues, there are other environmental factors, just other genetic factors that, you know, have an effect as well. And so health officials don't really like to say, yes, this happened because of lead poisoning.
So there is no definitive way of knowing, and that, again, I guess leads to the fear and the animosity mm-hmm. and the uncertain knowing that these residents have about what caused this, what could potentially cause this in the future as well.
We should remember, though, that the city has been offering blood lead testing for, mm-hmm. for children and anybody.
Off and on through the last several years, am I right?
Yes, but they've particularly been pushing it for since July, and they have been strongly encouraging parents who haven't gotten children tested to bring them into the health department to get tested, mm-hmm. and also for those that have gotten preliminary positive to come back and get confirmatory testing. So they do a finger prick the first time, and then they want them to come back and do a blood draw for the second test to confirm it.
Okay.
And then the state is providing case management services for children who are above the threshold.
And do we
and
have,
if I can add, sorry, if I can add one quick thing there. That testing has actually been offered to any resident of the city. So
okay.
it's not just people that live in the affected area, but the mm-hmm. entire city.
Okay. And if you're a resident of East Chicago, where do you go?
I believe the city's health department, and then, if I'm not mistaken, Trustee Frank Mervan has had some, I don't know if they're still there, but I believe he's had somebody in the area, so you can work with them to get your testing. And, of course, you can always go to your normal doctor that you
And I guess mm-hmm. what about the person maybe who lives in Fort Wayne or lives in South Bend or West Lafayette who says, you know what, I lived there for 20 years and just moved. Are they going to have available blood testing, or do they have to go in on their own dime as well to get that covered?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
The city has said that if you have an ID that says East Chicago on it,
okay.
You
so
can
if you've
do
moved,
it,
you don't. But I suppose probably the best bet is to call the city and find out what your
I would
options
ask.
Are.
If I were someone who had moved out, yep. Especially recently, I would call and find out. And
call the health department. I know they're also offering some clinics weekly at Carrigash.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Community Conversations here on Lakeshore Public Radio, streaming online at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. We're taking your calls, comments, and questions at 219-769-9577, 219-769-9577, as well as the hashtag AskLead if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns about the West Calumet Housing Complex lead contamination crisis. And let's talk about now, as we've got about 15 minutes left here, the role of the EPA and local government. There have been reports about predatory lawyers and scam artists mm-hmm. who've been approaching residents. We ran a story from our own Stephen Lattimore. They're getting them into limousines to go ahead and sign paperwork. How ethical is this? And
it's not.
Do you have to have a security guard present to go ahead and make sure, or each Chicago police officer to make sure, no, you can't get into limousines? What is the process? It kind of feels like the wild, wild west in terms of scam artists and what people can do.
One of the unfortunate things that happens whenever there is a tragedy, a horrible situation like this, not all of us walking on this earth are angels, and people mm-hmm. look at it as a way to target people that are scared, they're angry, they don't know what to do, and basically separate them from their money. And so, yeah, we've had some conversations with people. We've walked around. There was talked about the limo showing up and taking people out to dinner to get them to sign. There have been different community meetings that have taken place, and we've told people and strongly suggested to people, do not sign anything with anybody because you don't want to possibly cause your – well, first of all, you don't want to be taken advantage of.
Yeah. Right?
You also don't want to sign something and then whatever the benefits, the things that are allowed to you as a resident, you now lose those because you've now gotten into some sort of legal situation with somebody. And then just also – that also just will – you know, if you have 150 – I know that's an exaggeration, but for effect, 150 different lawyers that are going at this and suing this, it's just going to make the situation convoluted mm-hmm. and make it harder for everyone to get mm-hmm. everything to get worked out. So I don't know if there's something that the city or the state, well, maybe the Attorney General, actually, I think the Attorney General's office might be able to play a role in this in terms of stopping that from happening and taking advantage of people.
On that note, who's suing who? There's been a lot of lawsuits that have been filed. Sarah, you reported Sergeant Shriver, National Center on Poverty Law, has filed a housing discrimination complaint alleging the city department is not complying with obligations under federal law to safely relocate residents, end quote. The citizens of the West Calumet Housing Complex have now hired a lawyer as well in their defense. Can you talk more on that?
I'm aware of at least two tort notices, which are notices to the city that an attorney plans to file a lawsuit on behalf of someone. I did see one federal lawsuit that's been filed, but I'm not aware of anything else at this point. That doesn't mean that the attorneys haven't filed those tort notices and not let us know, because those aren't necessarily public records.
Okay.
Yeah, and can I add to that,
Nick,
a little bit? The Shriver complaint you mentioned, it isn't actually a lawsuit. It's a housing discrimination complaint filed with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So
I guess explain that. What does that mean, a housing discrimination complaint versus a lawsuit?
Yeah, so it's basically what that law center is doing is on behalf of, I think it's 7 or 8 residents of the West Calumet Housing Complex, have filed an administrative complaint with HUD saying basically that the East Chicago Housing Authority did not properly prepare and notify residents that they were going to demolish the housing complex. And so HUD will now review all that relevant information and make a decision on whether or not the East Chicago Housing Authority did act appropriately, or if, you know, they'll basically support the ECHA's decision to handle the matter as they did, or they could fine the East Chicago Housing Authority for handling it improperly, or they could refer that complaint to the Justice Department, which would open up a lawsuit.
Okay, and so with the role of the East Chicago Housing Authority, let's talk about the local government angle. Former mayors George Pabe from 05 to 10, Robert Pastrick from 72 to 04, and John Nicosia from 63 to 71. What kind of a role do they have in this? Where does the blame lie on their feet? Because we've seen a lot, I guess, publicly from current East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland, who's been very vocal against the EPA. He's released every single letter to the public that he sent to the EPA. He's the one who wants to raise the complex. He wants to tear it down, despite the EPA saying, no, we don't, or that wasn't part of our plans. Going back, did these mayors know about this issue? Are they the ones that greenlit this, or?
To be clear, it was the EPA that released the letters between the mayor and EPA. The city has released 2 timelines documenting what's happened. As far as what the other mayors knew or didn't know, that's unclear. We have requests pending with the city for documents, but we haven't really figured it out yet.
And Nick, you just recently were at an East Chicago City Council meeting. They did not discuss the West Calumet lead issues. However, you did learn that they had only just found out about this a couple of weeks ago. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually in one of the timelines that the city released. And this, you know, some of the residents, I feel like they haven't been receiving, you know, timely communications. I mean, it seems like there has been, you know, sort of some mishaps at a lot of different levels. For instance, you know, the EPA feels like they have been notifying the city at the appropriate moments, which is true. Their, you know, primary point of contact has been the mayor's office. The city council, or the common council, as it's called, was only officially briefed on the matter in August, though. So, you know, months after the EPA released their finalized lead soil results to the mayor back in May.
So it's already been a couple of months, and the council doesn't know about it. The residents don't really know about it either, do they, Sarah or Lauren? I guess based on who you've spoken with, I can assume that a lot of people, along with the fear aspect that we talked about, a lot of people still that unknown aspect in terms of going back to those different sections or zones rather, 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
Are my, you know, do I get a housing voucher to move? Do I not? You know, how long has the city known about this? Why have things been swept under the rug?
Right, and I think that that's important to note too, that a lot of these residents in West Calumet in particular are transient. Mm-hmm. You know, they could be there for as long as 6 months. They could be there for generations, as we talked about. But then you've got zones 2 and 3 that are residential. You may have, again, generations of families who are living there that are living there and continue to live there. In zones 2 and 3, with the residents I've spoken with, you know, they are worried about who knew what when. I think when it comes to residents in the West Calumet complex, they really don't know what to think because it's all brand new information to them. They're not from the area, and they didn't know this was happening, and the soil was contaminated.
So there, I guess we should note that there are public records that are made available from the EPA notifying residents, but not continuously. And I don't know how this works in terms of moving, but you know, if somebody say moves in 2008 and a notice was posted in 2006, for example, which is a couple of years prior to, do those residents have to be notified that a notice was posted for lead contamination?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but you know, I do know that we have sought records of lease agreements between the East Chicago Housing Authority. Did they have to disclose whether there was any lead hazards? And according to HUD regulations, if there is a known lead hazard, mm-hmm. That disclosure has to be made.
But at that point, I wonder out loud and maybe incorrectly, how far down in the paperwork does that one have to be notified? You know, is it page 7 of your lease document? At that point, you're just signing off because you're getting hand cramps, you know. Or if there's not a doctor present, if there's not a pediatrician that says, hey, these are the effects that lead poisoning can have on your children, you know, is the knowledge even there for these residents?
I believe that there is some requirement to give out the lead education pamphlet, mm-hmm. You know, at least at some point over this time period. But again, you know, if a parent hears, okay, there's lead in the soil, what does that mean?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, not everyone's going to understand what that means. And okay, there's lead. Okay, great. Or you just let me know because I need to know, or do I need to know because of the health issue? And not
right.
everyone's going to understand that. And if I'm not mistaken, and I can't give you an exact date, I believe when the city was informed by EPA, I believe the mayor sent out a letter to the whole area,
okay,
to all the residents in the area to let them know, hey, this is what's going on. And I believe it may have informed people that they strongly suggest or telling people they should get out because it's an unhealthy situation.
Okay. And getting out because it is an unhealthy situation means they're getting housing vouchers and they're able to move. Well, the housing vouchers only became effective on September 1st. Is that correct? So just literally 2 weeks ago, but this is something that people have known about since June and July. They haven't been able to get out early. You spoke earlier about issues with moving residents, that you can't just pick up the 1,000 people who live in the West Calumet housing complex, and you can't just move them to another unoccupied section of East Chicago. So how does this work in the last couple of minutes here with regards, because this is HUD housing, correct? Housing and mm-hmm. Urban Development. How do those vouchers work? Can they move anywhere? Can they move to Crown Point, Portage, Valpo, Munster, another part of East Chicago? Does it have to be specific housing? What are the options that residents have?
So if I'm not mistaken, when it comes to the vouchers, the normal process, I believe, is a minimum of 90 days. Mm-hmm. And in this case, because of the urgency of it, it was actually less than 90 days. I cannot tell you exactly the amount.
60 days with
60 days?
Request for extension.
Okay. My understanding is residents can move anywhere in the country. So
okay.
If they can find a place in East Chicago or in Northwest Indiana. Or
they can get as far away from lead contamination as possible.
They can go to Alaska, I presume.
Yeah.
So they can move anywhere, and there's assistance and help that's provided in that in terms of moving costs, I believe, packing, et cetera, et cetera. So there's not just get out, go here's a voucher, go find someplace, but there's some support that's put in.
And the Times, Sarah and Lauren, I believe you reported on the East Chicago Housing Authority also requesting initially $1.9 million and now another $1.3 million. So are we still at that same number, or is the ECHA
AJ, there we go. Still requesting more money. Is more money still needed?
Right. So HUD actually approved $1.9 million, okay. I think it was, 2 months ago, for the actual voucher values. And then the East Chicago Housing Authority Board voted, last week, to actually use some of its capital dollars to assist with moving costs, transportation costs, within a 50-mile radius. So that's kind of interesting, too. You know, there are limits as to, in terms of moving assistance, if you go beyond that 50-mile radius. But there's $1.9 million in voucher value. And then HUD has estimated that $1.2 million is needed for in moving assistance.
So moving is not cheap. I mean, you need to have a deposit, maybe first month's and or last month's rent. You're paying for a moving truck. You know, it costs a lot to just uproot your lives, and people don't always have that money. What happens to those people maybe who want to move outside of that 50-mile radius and don't have that money? The options then become limited.
Right. That's definitely a question on everyone's mind. You know, what happens when you want to leave East Chicago or, you know, the region?
Yeah.
What kind of help will you get then? One thing I wanted to point out, too, HUD emailed me, actually a representative of HUD emailed me today. They said no families have relocated using their vouchers as of Friday. And about 20 families with vouchers have reported limited progress so far in finding a unit. So they will provide additional counseling for those families. And that is in place, too. There are resources available. You know, if a family is having difficulty with finding a unit, HUD has a contractor on the ground providing counseling specifically for that.
And there's some other help. I believe there's some families that have been relocated to hotels.
Right, the EPA is doing that. Right?
And then I believe
that's only during the deep cleaning when they do the units. Okay. Temporary.
And I think there has also been some forgiveness in terms of bills, like electric bills and things
NIPSCO.
Like that.
NIPSCO. NIPSCO agreed to their, they're forgiving debt, and they're I think they're also waiving.
But again, East Chicago Housing Authority is paying for that.
Okay.
Paying NIPSCO too.
So the residents don't have to take on that.
Okay.
The burden off their shoulders.
Yeah.
There.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to go very quickly around the horn. Nick, I'll start with you. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet about the West Calumet Housing Complex lead contamination and arsenic crisis that you'd like to go ahead and get out?
Well, I'll just add a little bit to this. You know, latest discussion on housing. Another thing residents should be aware of is that they can move anywhere with those vouchers. However, to receive a voucher, you have to attend a briefing. Basically, you learn how to use it. And briefings for residents interested in moving outside of East Chicago don't start until October. So what was a 60-day window with a 30-day extension ultimately becomes a 30-day window.
Okay. Sarah Reese, Northwest Indiana Times.
Just, you know, that the residents have to move out of the West Calumet Housing Complex, but EPA is planning to start excavation in Zone 3, and those residents are expected to stay in their homes during the work.
Okay. Lauren Cross?
Really, I mean, the next, issue we're going to tackle is, you know, the housing availability in the area, and really what's next if the EPA is testing for lead in these new units, and those are some of the questions we have right now.
Yeah, I was going to say housing in Northwest Indiana is definitely not cheap. We are we're paying Chicago prices, unfortunately. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be I'm looking forward, I guess, to that follow up as well. And then State Representative-elect Earl Harris Jr.
So one of the things that we need to look at is this is going to be a long term situation. You know, we were talking earlier, and I mentioned it's like dropping a pebble in water and watching it ripple out. So there's going to be lots of things affected. There are probably going to be some things that pop up that we haven't even thought of yet, because there's been things that I didn't know about at first. One of the things we need to look at as a state, and I've had some conversation with people in the state house as well as other elected officials up here, is we're sitting as a state on $2.24 billion, I believe, that's supposed to be used for rainy day for emergencies. Well, as I've said this before, this is an emergency on steroid.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had some conversations about how we can put in legislation requests, however I should officially phrase that, to look at what sort of funding will be needed in this area to tap into those funds once the session starts in January. This is not going to go away in the next week or two.
It certainly won't. And I want to thank all of you for joining us here on Community Conversations. If you missed any of the broadcast this evening, please go ahead and head over to lakeshorepublicmedia.org tomorrow for the podcast. It'll be available on Facebook and Twitter as well. And we will keep this conversation going hopefully with more updates in the near future. Thank you so much for listening to Community Conversations here on Lakeshore Public Radio, streaming online at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. It's coming up on 8:01, and we will now join the BBC here on Lakeshore Public Radio.